I'm Dave Bella, and this is a forum of stories. And this forum arose, I went to Walt Session, and those of you who've been to Walt Session know it's a really dynamic, really moving session. But the thing that really grabbed me is a lot of the things he was saying fit so well to my own experience. And my experience was in engineering, and my sessions are on the limitations of technology. And I found out I was ending up, you know, by studying the limitations of this technological world, ending up in the same, largely the same place Walt was in. In other words, we live in this technological world where you're supposed to explain things rationally and practically and objectively, and yet what we discovered is that the real basis of meaning that we really need comes from our involvement and our communication with stories. And all of this rational technological world doesn't mean anything if it's not nurtured by the actual experiences that we share with each other. And that one of the things I think our society, as a technological society, is missing is the sharing of stories, not as entertainment, but as something essential to life. Okay? And that's kind of a discovery that I came about by studying the limitations of technology and then saying there must be something more, and when we have to talk about something more, we end up telling stories. So that's where I'm coming from. Okay? Walt has a whole different experience. Walt, why don't you go ahead and...
I'm going to ask one or two of you to forgive me because I'm going to repeat a thought or two that we did in discussion last Friday afternoon. Jim, you were here for that. I'm going to say something that makes me sad, and maybe some of you will recognize what I'm talking about. It's a consequence of this technological age that we even make technology out of our stories. But I'm going to say it two ways. First, I want to tell you about a dream I had last night. This is true. Dan, what was the name of that little girl that I was holding in Vespers?
Claire Bear.
Huh? What?
Claire Bear.
Claire Bear?
Claire.
Claire? They call her Claire Bear for long? Okay. Little tiny child. Her parents... Oh, it's time to start.
Don't worry.
Her parents... are on staff here. They're long-term staff. Her father's carpenter. Her mother is the one that sang the Vespers last night, okay? I was holding her during the Vespers, and I had a dream about her last night, which is strange. It was early enough this morning that I remember it. We were standing, I think my family and this little child, Claire, and other adults were standing on the edge of a sea. Very clear lake. It was smooth. It wasn't wild. But I was afraid, and I kept telling everybody, I said, watch the children, they can fall in, watch the children. And exactly what I was afraid of happened. Claire was standing right at the edge, and if you saw her last night or see her sometimes, she's an irrepressible child and bounces all around the place, and I lost my heart because I saw that child fall into the water, and it was clear water. So I saw her sink all the way to the bottom and lay still. And I remember that I dived into the water and I swam, and I could see clearly under the water where she was lying on her stomach on the bottom of this sea. And I went after her as I was swimming, and I tried to take hold of the child, and she kept slipping out of my hands. Now that panicked me while I was holding my breath and seeing the bleary world above me through the water. I couldn't get a hold of her, and finally I took what was a dangerous hold, I thought, I don't know why, but I yanked her by her arm, and I yanked her out of the water and came exploding up and trying to grab breath and put Claire on the side. And then she wasn't dead. All the feelings that I had in that dream, though, translate to something that might make sense, especially to those of you that are older. I don't know about to those of you that are younger. You can tell me. I say out loud, and I say in our society, watch the children, or I want to turn it around and I want to say, watch the elders. Children, listen to your elders. In the Old Testament, they make much, and I'll put these two things together, they make much out of blessing. Abraham blesses Isaac. Isaac blesses Jacob and then Esau, and Esau is profoundly hungry and angry, hungry for the blessing that Jacob got. And he almost, even though Esau by that time is grown up and he's a hairy person and he's got great big muscles and he hunts in the woods, he still acts very much like a child, and he says, Father, don't you have one blessing for me? Blessing was very important to the elderly and to the young. Jacob, when he comes to be very old, in the 49th chapter of Genesis, brings all of his children and blesses them one at a time. And it's only just a few verses for each blessing. But those few verses bring together three things. They say something of the past. Something of perhaps the father's past, but they say something of the child. They say what Reuben did to his father's concubine. Something in the past. They say what Simeon and Levi did. They look to the past. They are speaking in the present, and they identify the future, if that makes any sense to you. The elderly in Scripture, that very short thing of this compulsive thing that they want to pass on to the young and that the young want very much to receive, binds the times together. It says, because this is what we have been, and because this is what we are, you might expect this is what we'll be. It creates continuity. Now here come the words. Generation to generation. I say, watch the children and listen to the elders, because people, God gave us still that strong compulsion to do exactly the same thing, and the elders still have it. It is to tell stories. It is to bless. It is to bless the younger generation. I watch as my parents get older now, and my father is, how old is he? Somebody, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? I say, how old is my dad?
He must be 65 or 66. I'm 66.
You're 66. Okay, he must be that, 66 or so. Classmates to my dad. And the last time that I was with my parents, it was amazing how my mother would go into a kind of a trance, and she'd say, your grandfather. She'd say, your grandfather used to be a bouncer. I didn't know this, but all of a sudden I've got to sit and listen to my grandfather, how he used to during Prohibition. Yeah, you have to go. This is St. Louis, and it's right next to the cemetery. I get this big story from my mother about her father. And these little speakeasies would be down in the basements, but these Germans would come and make noise anyway. And when they made too much noise, my grandfather, who was a graveyard caretaker, would get called in. Great big man, William Stork. And William Stork would come in, says my mother, into the speakeasy, and if there'd be an old drunk Herman there, he'd grab Herman by his belt and by his collar, literally, and walk him out and cross the street and go to the cemetery, which had a brick wall around it, and throw Herman into the cemetery. Because he figured out that if Herman woke up next to a tombstone, maybe he'd think next time before he drank. Okay, now I bring this all back. That's what my mother told me. I never knew that. And as I started to listen, I began to understand what my mother was doing. Yes, she was telling me stories, but more than that, she was blessing me. She was letting me see two generations ahead of myself. She was letting me see my grandfather. In my grandfather, I could begin to perceive myself. If I understand my grandfather and myself, I can begin to understand the future, and then there is continuity. Those of you with the white hairs on your head, know how hard it is to remember yesterday, or where you put that brooch, or what happened to the mixmaster and all that kind of stuff. But you can remember 50 years ago, and you can remember that very specifically, and there is a compulsion to grab some kid who's running by and say, sit down, let me tell you about 50 years ago. This is what I mean about stories. This is the strong compulsion of our age to hold continuity generation by generation, and for God's sake, the television doesn't do it. The television doesn't have timbre, the television does not love you, the television can't touch you, you cannot smell a television, but you can smell the people that are talking to you. You can't ask a question, you can't cry in front of the television and the old person comes up and with very wrinkled hand pats you on the back of your hand and says, it's okay, it's okay. Television can't do that. What a television does is present you a story without blood and without life and without purpose. Well, it can be purpose if it's a well-done piece of art. I don't mean to trash the whole thing altogether. But what it isn't is your parent. What it isn't is your grandparent. And what it doesn't do is give you that continuity of history. That's my dream, do you understand? When I see the children run out the door and I see the children careless of this enormous amount of wisdom, which is not going to be passed on leaflets or in books, but by the timbre of their voices, and there is still that compulsion in them to tell, and the children run out the doors, I think those children are drowning. And they should be caught out of that sea, and they should be brought up, or listen to the adults, because those adults, those elders, who have this desire to tell stories of the past, which is going like whirlwind away from us right now. Those people with that, they can choke on those desires. Do you know that? It can gather up in their throat and they can choke on it and they can die. Because nobody gave them a place to draw their pictures. Nobody gave them a place to tell their stories. I don't know. That's what's good about a forum like this, but I would hope that a forum like this would continue as we go on. Mitch?
One little thing. One thing that, as I started thinking about this idea story, and I started thinking of the session we had on American story and American religion, on how the American story is a really distorted story. We hear of the pilgrims landing, and it's a kind of, and then of course you go through the whole history of conquering a land and technological development and all this, and the concept of progress. But for most of us, the real story is an immigrant story of people coming here and thrown out of a country, coming here with nothing, and being the underdog, and yet that we don't. That's really the American story. That's really the story of our ancestors. Very few of our ancestors go all the way back to the pilgrims, and yet when we read our story, our history, it's really not our story. Our real story involves people who may even in this room, and certainly my grandfather came over as an immigrant, and I think that's the kind of story, and there's a little tiny bit of it left because Americans tend to root for the underdog, because we're a nation of underdogs. And I think if we could remember those stories better, I think we would be a stronger people. I think we would live in this world in a little more humble way because we'd identify with the underdog a little bit. Maybe part of the problems we're having right now, say in international and the use of our power, is we've forgotten our roots. Our roots are really the roots of the underdog from various nations that used to. You take all of our nations that we came from back in Europe, they shoot each other all the time, and now we're all interrelated. That's a beautiful story. And yet we don't tell it. We don't tell it. Okay, so I think right now maybe we ought to stop. And people want to add things or tell stories. Let's do it. Yes?
There was two things popping up in my mind as you were. And this is, it's not exactly a story, but the effect of story with the congregation I'm with. In the last year or so, I've been working with one person in particular in the congregation that's been very, very sick. And it's been very difficult for that person particularly. Frankly, it's also been very difficult for me. I'm a darling lady, and I'm conscious that there are at least a couple people here who knew her. But very unhappy person. I mean, it was every time he went, it was I'm so okay. And after a while, I just got so tired of hearing that whining that it really got to me. There's another lady in our congregation who's 96 years old and who was my healer when I was after coming up there, go see Mabel. Now, you had to have a lot of time because it used to take 20 minutes to get from the couch to the front door because you'd get up and you'd get about that far. And then my grandfather on the farm, and it was another 20 minutes, you know. You had to be willing to deal with that. But it was marvelous, a healing experience, just to sit there and have this person bubble out. Just exactly what you're talking about, stories of 50 and 60 and 70 years ago, and sometimes 85 years ago. And it was a very, very healing, though time-consuming process. In the midst of that, I thought of one thing, and that is, I wish more of my people in my congregation, regardless of their age, would grandparent the newer people as they were coming into the congregation. in the last couple of years, we've had a big influx. So anybody here who's been in a congregation more than 3 years, I don't care how old you are now a grandparent to anyone who comes into a congregation now. Grandparent them. Do what you're saying. Tell stories of the congregation. Tell what it is that made that congregation meaningful to you while you've been in it. And that process will help whoever joins the congregation not just be a member, but be adopted into the congregation. And that's a powerful part of the story.
Okay. I'd like to see if we have some stories. Maybe just, we will have to keep them short because there's so many. That's hard. That's harder than making them long. Somebody have some stories, some old stories. I'd like to. Some Becca way back. Just little things.
All the books are shut.
Yes.
My father was a Luther minister, and he used to tell me about stories. He was 48 when I was born, so he was born in 1900, and he came across the country by car. And I can remember as when I was small, we used to take trips to Midwest. He'd say, "There's the old road," or "There's where I used to go." And I think in the process of just going, we'd hear stories about about what happened when, you know, there weren't roads and there weren't signs and there weren't markers. And he was with his family and he was in Montana, and he got directions where he thought there was supposed to be a paved road. And they drove, they looked and it was dark, and they drove they drove off a ferry pier into the water. And he had, this was like 1928, and he had two kids in the car with him. And they got everything out, and his Bible that he got when he got out of the seminary from his dad, the water had soaked through. And it soaked through to the passage, it said, "And the angels should take charge over you."
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the Bible is still around, and it's just a testimony of that. And that's the kind of story that's stuck in my mind.
Good. Sometimes the things that hold stories have become themselves sacred, like that book. In old Israel, a hill would be sacred, or a tree, a terebinth oak would be sacred because of what had happened there. And sometimes when you begin to seek for stories in your own lives, it's like that Bible. Look for the concrete thing that has become somehow or other sacred. You couldn't sell it because nobody else would want it, but you wouldn't want to sell it because it contains the wholeness of a living, sweating, and bloody memory. All of you, look for that thing that you hold sacred, or have you nothing sacred anymore? A shawl, a brooch, a shoe, a book, a pen, a comic book. What do you hold sacred? What holds the deity in it, the deity of your family, the Newman of your family, that thing which contains your family? What do you have?
I'll tell a story about my grandfather, who was an immigrant from Sweden. Had 12 children, one of whom was my mother. She was the middle of the family. When I was young, we did not live in the area where my grandfather lived on the farm. We lived in North Dakota, they lived in Minnesota. So we didn't see my grandfather very often. When we did go, I think it had been 3 years since I had seen him, and I was probably 8, 9. My mother said before we got there, "I want you to sing for my dad. He doesn't hear well, so sing loudly." Well, I couldn't remember that from my last experience that he was hard of hearing. But we did. We had all the family was there. It was a joyous time. And I sang. And he was very happy. You could see it. He was just beaming. I don't know how much he heard. And there was such a commotion around, I don't remember all the detail. But I remember when we left that evening, he took my hand and he put something in it and he closed my hand and he said, "Thank you, Paul." And I opened my hand up and there was a silver dollar. And I know he didn't have many of those. I still have that silver dollar.
Yeah.
And it's a symbol to me of what our father must be like. Because I expected nothing from him. And yet he gave me so much. You know, love is just there. And it's, to me, it's a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a missionary to India. And in 1954, when he came back, he stopped and stood in Switzerland and brought some colored paintings of the Stern. There are 4 daughters in my family, and I'm the only one that's been to the Stern besides my parents. And last December, my birthday, I got these 2 pictures framed. Well, my first reaction was, oh, what are these pictures for? And then my mother told me the story that her father had brought these from the Stern. And she was slowly giving us piece by piece that her father had. And now the family on my wall, and I think of the travels that my grandfather had been through and the many years he served in India.
The last time I told the story, Anderson, I'll remember this, but was during a congregational call meeting.
As filler, well, they're counting the ballots. The meeting turned out already anyway, but it's a personal story. I grew up in Market County, Michigan, a good part of my life in a house attached to the county jail. It was sort of a magnificent county jail. It was about 4 stories high, could fit about 125 people, although it was more cozy during that. I was built during Prohibition, and that's probably a factor. But my father was county sheriff, and my father was a good sheriff, but ran jail pretty well. And my mother was the cook for the jail, and my mother was a reasonably decent cook, and fed pretty well. And so that there was some sense among a certain group of individuals that the jail was not a bad place to come to.
I'll use the names because I don't, I really don't have to protect them. They probably died of sclerosis or whatever or something.
I remember particularly 2 individuals, and I remember them because they were frequently there. I remember seeing a field water one time with this one fellow that was there for his 53rd trip. But these two guys, one was a professional hobo. I remember telling a story about being at a hobo convention someplace in Iowa or something like that. And the other was worked in the woods. But they were friends. They got picked up in a little town up the road in Ishpeming. There are 2 towns, Ishpeming and Agana and Wentland. One was the Indian name for heaven and the other for hell. It was really not very easy to make a distinction between the two, but those were the 2 names of the towns. And they got picked up in kind of middle November because winter was coming on. And actually the best dinners, the best meals were Thanksgiving and Christmas. I mean, the feeding was pretty good most of the time, but Thanksgiving and Christmas, my mother outdid herself. And they were picked up and brought before the judge in this town. And the first child, his name was Enokoski. Because of his profession, they called him Bonkoski, was sentenced drunk and disorderly 60 days. Well, he sat down relatively satisfied. That would carry through a good part of the misery. The second fellow stood up, and I don't remember his real name, but his nickname was Funky. I don't know what that entailed, but that was his nickname. And he came before the judge, and the judge banged his gavel, and drunk and disorderly, 90 days. Now, nobody knows why that discrepancy between the 2 sentences, but Bonkoski immediately discerned the injustice of it. And says, "Your Honor, I object. How can
down, he gets 90 days, and I only get 60. The judge knows these two gentlemen rather well, and he said, Bob Kosky, you sit down and shut up, or you won't get anything. Living in a county jail where you got to know the residents rather intimately, my parents instilled in me at least some sense of a classless society. And I see that as somewhat of a gift.
Treasuring little momentous from the past is something that I really particularly interested in, because I've inherited a little brown booklet that my grandfather used as a diary, and a little book that he wrote favorite poems and notes in. He bought it in Germany. He got a date in there, 1837. And he has a diary in there of his coming over here. He came from Austria in 1881. And it's all written in beautiful handwritten German. I've been able to translate the diary part, and it's the only really connection I have with that part of my family. Because it's funny, when you grow up, you don't think of asking your parents or your grandparents of where they came from, or what happened and so on, why did they do this and that. You don't think of it then, because there are others. Anyway, the first sentence is in German. I can't say it in German, but it says, I've decided to go to America. And in that little sentence, it just intrigues me, because I wonder why. And I have to piece this all together. And I feel an obligation to my own family and my own children to pass it on. So my project in the next year or so is to translate that and make it available to my own children and my own family. But I sometimes feel a little that my grandfather has failed me a little bit, because he goes into very much detail of his coming over, ship, 3 weeks on the ocean, coming into England and so on, coming in trying to find his way in this country. But the last part is just, we had a bad year, just barley was bad, no feed for the horses, no grain, and they reveal something, of course, but they didn't say anything about it. And it doesn't mention my grandmother at all. I don't know why that is. So I think we feel that. But just to remind you folks that a little thing like that is just treasure. It's a little treasure that I just seal up, keep in the strong box, so it doesn't, can pass it on to my own children. One reflection on your story of the girl. A number of years ago, our youngest daughter was 6 years old. We were out in California with the family. And we were visiting a friend of mine who had a beautiful swimming pool in Pasadena. And he invited us to use the swimming pool. So the children got in their suits and we all went around there. And beautiful, you know how they are, they're down there like this. And our children never been in a pool like that. And I was standing on the edge fortunately, a little girl stepped off and just sank down in the clear water. I was right there and watched her. And she just looked up at me. Her hair was floating. I just looked at her. And I reached down and just grabbed her arm and pulled her up. Nothing of fright or anything until afterwards. Yeah. Every time I think of it, it just gives me shivers.
Yeah.
It was just so, she just looked just like, well, Daddy, you'll just put your hand down here. And,
wow.
Speaking of carrying on family traditions, my children are relatively young right now. My oldest is 5 and my youngest is 2.5. And I became very concerned that they would not be able to hear the story of their grandparents and great-grandparents' lives, because they're quite old now. My grandfather is 92. And my husband's grandfather's 91. And so I asked each of them to write down the story of their lives and how they came to America and as much as they can remember of their parents and their parents' parents, and to write it down. And I've been having them read it on a cassette tape, and I've been cataloging it according to family, so that when my children are older and my grandparents are gone and passed on, they will be able to hear the tradition, you know, that were family traditions.
Neat. I'm really envious of those of you that have had grandparents. My parents married young in the state of New York. My father had work in the state of Michigan, so they moved out there. By the time I was born, both my grandfathers had died, one of natural causes, one in an airplane accident, and my grandmothers were 500 miles away. Once a year, without fail, we'd go out there and I would see these elderly ladies that couldn't touch me enough, but I didn't really know, unfortunately. When I was in high school, in an effort to please my parents, I thought I would pursue the field of medicine. And one of the steps to doing that was getting a job in a local hospital as an orderly. Attached to this hospital was a nursing home, where young high school kids were often sent to do the dirty work, literally, as well as figuratively. And getting oriented at the nursing home, I was told right away who to look out for and who was easy and who wasn't. Some of these people you had to give complete bed baths to. I was, as a male orderly, I was assigned to men. It was Gwendolyn Maines, Boone Bennett, Wilson, and Wiley. Gwendolyn Maines, real calm, Boone Bennett. But there was also another man at the end of the hall, Homer Blair. His room was right next to the nursing station. Now, the first day I went by there, something came flying out of the room, and I was scared. And he said, "Don't worry, that's just Homer. He doesn't like the food. I'll take care of Homer, or call Mrs. Jones. She takes care of Homer real well." She was an old black woman. And she'd be in there and she'd say, "Now, Homer, you just behave yourself. Now, you don't need to, you get out of here. You just get out of here." And I hear stuff fly, and I thought bad things were happening. Well, I was intrigued. And I asked Mrs. Jones about him, and she said, "Well, don't you know, well, Homer's 99 years old, and he's going to be 100 in a couple of months." Well, I'd never seen anybody that old, let alone talk to him. Homer was bedridden, but his mind was as sharp as a knife. He'd lost an eye somehow, and he had glasses that were as thick as Coke glass, the Coke bottle bottoms. He'd take off those glasses and there'd just be, he didn't have a false eye, but there was just, you know, the eyelid hanging there and the other eye looking there, and through those thick glasses, the one eye looked about the size of a baseball. And Mrs. Jones was gone one day on the afternoon shift, and we're passing the meal trays around. I don't know how many of you have been in nursing home or sort of, and you can pass the trays around. I was nominated to go in and give Homer his tray. "Be careful," they told him. Homer doesn't always like soup. I took the tray and I crept in. He said, "Who is it?" I said, "Jim." "Who?" I said, "Jim." "I don't know you." "Well, I'm new here." "I've got your dinner." "What is it? Soup?" Yeah, soup. "I don't want any soup. Get out of here. Get out." And he, sure enough, he picked up the nearest thing that was there, which happened to be his urinal. There was no argument. I was out of the room. Homer wouldn't eat. However, in time, a relationship developed. We didn't just have to take in food. We had to take in water occasionally. And sometimes there would come a soft and feeble voice out of there. "Could I have some water?" And, well, when someone wants something and you have it, it develops a different kind of relationship here. And I took him in his water. And he said, "Would you sit down for a minute?" And I said, "Well, sure." And he didn't say anything for it seemed like an eternity. And he said, "What's your name?" I said, "Jim." Sure that he'd forgotten, it'd been a week. He said, "I remember you. You had the soup." Yeah, well, I said, "I've only got water this time." He goes, "It's okay. It's okay." Well, I got in dope on Homer. He'd been a bank president in a town of about 20,000 people for a long time. I was curious why, what he'd done with his life, so I asked him. And more so, I was curious on what he attributed his success in life to. He'd been a fairly successful man. And so I asked him, I said, Mr. Blair?
Yeah?
I said, you seem to have accomplished quite a bit in your life, huh? I said, you seem to have accomplished quite a bit in your life. I was told that you were the president of the bank here.
27 years.
I said, well, I said, to what one thing would you attribute your success in life? And it came that pause again. And he looked at me and the eyes seemed to grow. And he said, working like hell. He went on to tell me, though, the story of his life. He said that when he was about 17, 18 years old, he went away to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which is now about an hour's drive on the freeway, and I think it took considerably a lot longer time to go there. He came back after a year. His father was a farmer, and started spouting out radical agriculture theories to his father, and his father decided that college wasn't the thing for his son. Took him by the nape of the neck and took him down to the local pharmacist and said, here, he'll work for you for a year for free, you just feed him. And he said that's where he got his start. Well, I told you Homer Blair was about 2 months shy of turning 100 years old. I was about 2 months shy of turning 18 years old. In Michigan, that was a legal age to drink. Among the stories that Homer told me, one was about going to the World's Fair in Chicago, where Pabst got its blue ribbon. So,
1893.
Right, that makes sense. He was a young man at the time. In fact, Homer and I was to turn 18 years old the day that Homer turned 100 years old, January 27th. So I talked to his doctor and I said, what would happen if he was to have a beer if he wanted? The doctor said, nothing at all. So on his 100th birthday, of course, his second or third wife was in, and a few well-wishers, and they had a small ceremony, but I worked the afternoon shift again. It happened to be a Friday. And I bought him in a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. He had probably his last beer, and I had my first one there that night. That night, Homer asked me to come in, and he told me, if I sat by his bed all night, he said he wanted someone there. If I sat there, he would write me a check for $1,000 in the morning. Now, Homer was a wealthy man. Why he was in this nursing home, I don't know. But he had the money, and his wife often came in to have him sign checks. Well, I couldn't stay there all night. I didn't want to stay there all night, particularly. He was going to do all right, I think. But I was scheduled to work at 7 the next morning anyway. So I came in bright and early at 7 after I put Homer to bed and sat down. And when I came in after report, I looked in, Homer's still sleeping, so just to be clever, I went in and sat down by the bed. Now, I wouldn't have taken the money. Homer woke up and he said, Jim, you still there? I said, yeah. But you left. That's right. Homer died 2 months later. 2 months to the day, in fact, on March 27th. It was the first time I think I really had a chance to talk with somebody I felt was a sort of a living relic of the age. And it was, I'm all for you having recorded the voices of your grandparents. I wish I could hear mine.
I worked with, I volunteered in a nursing home for a while, and the thing that impressed me is at times it was like they at the one end of the spectrum were like children at the other end in the way they didn't like, you know, they feared, they had certain fears and there were certain, also there were certain characters. Kids that were real talkative as children, they grew up into talkative people in nursing homes. And there was this one lady, Myrtle. And Myrtle would, we went to ice capades and she'd turn to the person in back for her and she'd say, "She's 106 years old," you know, and tell, you know, start telling ages of all the people around it, but they're all lies. And the one impressive thing happened when we took them down to see King Tut, you know, and we were wheeling them through there, and these were relics, you know, and we were pushing them up so they could see that these ancient things, and they got all the way through, and they got to the end, and the man showing them walked up to Myrtle, and he says, "Well, what did you think of King Tut?" And she says, "What the hell was that all about?" Bless her all.
Yes.
Our mother's parents were born in Norway, and my sister and I had heard a lot of stories about Norway, and in 1965 we went over to visit our relatives, and we went up to northern Norway, past the Arctic Circle, up north of Buda, up into the country where our grandparents came from, saw the house in which my grandmother was born. The home is now about 300 years old. During that visit, we heard a lot about Mother's visit to Norway in 1936 before she got married. She spent almost a year there, and we heard things that we had never heard her talk about. And it just made me feel so good to hear these things about my mother. They talked about the time that she made Christmas presents for all the children when they didn't have money to buy presents, and Mother got things together and made toys and skills that I did not know that my mother had. And she made ice cream out of the snow, and they still talk about that. The room she stayed in, they call Esther's room. Last year, we went back to Norway, and Mother went along, and we revisited all of the relatives there. And we heard the same story again with Mother there.
Oh, wow.
And it just was such a good feeling. During the same visit, both in 65 and this last year, we also visited Sweden. We took the same route. We have relatives from Oslo, clear up north, down to Stockholm. And our father was born in Sweden. And he talked about Sweden a lot. But we never got all of the details about things that that maybe he just didn't think were important to tell us. And we heard the stories of his side of the family and saw where he was born and heard the story about how he went to school. They had to put snowshoes on and put food on their back and walk miles into where the school was and then stay there all winter. And then they would come back in the spring. Things that he didn't tell us about, but it just made me feel so good. I feel so close to my family in Norway and Sweden. It's like they are just as close as my family, or maybe even closer.
There's a couple skeletal things from my that came from my grandfather that seemed to relate to me by my father, and I don't have any personal experience.
Talk a little louder, please.
My great-grandfather, they had a business in Switzerland, a clothing business, and had a governess and three kids. And when my grandfather was 14 or 15. His father told his wife that he was going, she had to get rid of the government. He was going to go to Spain, and if when he came back, the governess was not gone. He was going to divorce his wife and marry the governess. And out of spite, the wife kept the governess. My great grandfather did what he said. So now my grandfather is living with a stepmother. 3 years later, he's come to this decision point of what he's going to do in life, and his great-grandfather has four choices for him. He's going to be a minister, he's going to be a lawyer, he's going to be a doctor, or he's going to take over business. And Grandpa wants to be a farmer. And so Grandpa goes to America, and he spends 10 years trying this and that and another thing as regards farming. And ends up selling hides door to door in the Depression in San Francisco.
This is not an easy story for me to tell, but I'd like it. November of 79. My mother-in-law, who was 53 years old, sat down in a chair and a blood vessel broke in her heart and she was dead. She said. And that was very tragic, very unexpected. She was only 52. Her husband was a lot older, not as healthy, and we thought he would outlive her. And we got a phone call. We were really pretty upset by that and flew home. 3,000 miles back to Pennsylvania. I need to just say at this point, there's two major differences between my wife's family and my family. My folks are pretty right behind me. We moved to this country in 1949. My children are first generation. Mary's family lived in the same farm in Burke County in 1756, and two crazy relatives, her and one other, moved away in 230 years. I was not popular with that family. For having taken her away. So she had a tradition of a family that just was oppressive, frankly. That mother who died said, you may have 100 people at your wedding. And after we figured out all the relatives on her side that could come, I said to Mrs. Lundgood, you want my mother or my father? We ended up with 250 people. Anyway, we made the flight back. We got off the plane and we were met by a brother and a sister-in-law. And we're told that morning the oldest brother's wife had a miscarriage. And that was pretty devastating. Monday was the funeral. And Monday morning the brother that met us at the street at the airplane shot himself. And he was dead. And then Tuesday, her father had a heart attack. Wednesday I was in the emergency room. My folks couldn't live with that. With blood pressure that was just 220 over 100, he got over no blood. And I said to the doctor, why? He looked at me and said, what do you think, why? We had had all four of them that come through that emergency room in the last 4 days. So the following Wednesday was the funeral for the brother, which was not pleasant. And his funeral was at one end of the graveyard, and Grandma had been buried at the other end of the graveyard where the family was buried. And so we went with my two daughters, who were at that time 6 and 3, and they just wanted to know, how did Uncle Roger get that little box? He was cremated. They didn't understand. Why was Grandma dead? What was going on? What's going on here? And I thought to myself, you're wondering what's going on here. I have the obvious idea what's going on here. And so we started to do something. And I just realized this week what we started to do. One year's time, 11 years. And we started talking. Well, there are 7 generations in a row that go back. The others is in the more there in the but that's just the last 7 generations. 3 or 4 more generations myself. And we started talking about it. Did you know that Grandma Lefkowitz is this and here is Aunt Esther? Aunt Esther was too old to join World War I, so she lied about her age and went in as a nurse. And she died, and we don't know quite how old she was, and started telling jokes and
stories, and before we were done, just about 45 minutes, telling stories, and suddenly, at least I suddenly realized, how life and death are so much a part of the same thing. The stories that we were telling about these people, and then we got to the rows where I said, well, I didn't know these folks. They died before 1965, and I got a part of the family. And then we got to the row that my wife would say, well, this one died years before I was born, and here's one that died in another century, and but I know this about a great-grandfather Ivan, and he did this, and 45 minutes of storytelling. And the grieving process had begun, and healing had begun. It was finished, but it had begun. And that was very powerful.
Several years ago, spent a weekend in Washington, D.C. Had to work at both ends of the week. So I went to the National Archives and thought, for the heck of it, I would do a little bit of genealogical research. My father, long since deceased, had started some of that, and I knew something about family history. And I knew that some relatives had moved into a certain county in Illinois early in the 1800s and did what can be easily done, and that is pull out the census records from a particular period. I think I picked up 1840 or 1830 and started looking for the appropriate name and found one, and then found out that he had been born in upstate New York, which confirmed something I knew. So I went to the previous census, looked at the proper county in New York, started looking for names, got a very tingling feeling as I found the right name, where the person lived for appropriate occupation, and then knew something about family history out of Rhode Island, and found out the parents' name because of the census record, and then went back and pulled the census record for Rhode Island from, I think, perhaps, I don't know if it was the first census, but 1790 or 1800, and began looking. I didn't know exactly what it was, and that took a lot more time, but finally found the right name and the right place in Rhode Island, and that's still an unfinished task, but it was a rather mundane task, but talk about going back to family roots, finding out where people came from. I know there's more to be done there. Very, very enjoyable weekend.
Here. We'll start with the red shirt and the blue shirt.
My mother went to the Phoenix, Arizona last winter for the first time. And we visited her while she was there. And she asked me to be sitting with some group and was in the process of introducing herself. And the person who responded, my mother was 65. And they woman responded about 80 or so and said, well, were you Laverne Peterson? She said, yes. And the woman continued to tell her that she was the first baby that she had spanked. It turned out to be the assistant to the midwife that delivered my mother. And here they are, my mother, 65 years old, the assistant to the midwife, who was a teenager. But Nyla and I had a chuckle because not only was my mother born on the dining room table with the midwife, but my grandfather and her father had the task of being there and cutting the umbilical cord. And then this elderly woman told my mother about the whole process of her being born. But Nyla and I chuckled in part because we thought we were such modern by being in the delivery room.
How many things that are in my story,
I've already heard.
I just have a few.
Will you first, and then?
I just have a few. I don't have a story. I just have a few feelings that I wanted to share. I just finished the book this afternoon, Reflections, Diaries of Women, and it's excellent. Sarah, helping with our daughter, happened to have that at home. A history professor who she worked for at school did that for the whole thing. And I needed a book to bring along, and I took that along, and I finished it on this afternoon. And it just made me so aware that we need to write these things down. We need to have a record. I would recommend this book. It's just very, very excellent. And it comes, it's throughout history. There's some modern diaries and there's some very old. My mother is our family story, and we laugh about it. But we want anything checked on. We ask my mother, who lives in Minnesota, to keep track of everything that she has. What she doesn't have written down, she has it here. And it's just wonderful to have it. I've been saving some things, for instance, our two daughters. The letters that they have written since they left home, I've kept every one of them, and they're all in order. Last summer, our daughters took them out and went through them, and they just, it was their record of their college years, and they were so interesting. I'm very good now with our photograph album, and I'm now making notes in the book so that, you know, so I can date things, and I'll say confirmation. And then the date, and I've got all this, and I'm going to have it for me, but also for my children. So these are things that I think are important, and these stories that you brought us tonight, we all need to have somebody in the family keep them record. And one, a little ending to Paul's story about his grandfather. One thing I want you to know about this grandfather that is so precious to Paul, he came here at age 16 from Sweden. He never saw his family. His family, Sweden. He had 12 children, and his daughter, Alice, who is Paul's mother, wanted to see the remaining sister of her father. She was in her 90s, this was just a few years ago. She got back to Sweden and saw his aunt. And it was a moving experience for Alice, Paul's mother. And since then, there have been visits back and forth. Many visits. There have been several of these cousins from Sweden who visited. And this winter, our Sarah went to Sweden with the Gustavus Choir on tour in Sweden. And she only spent a short time in Stockholm, but two of the relatives met her at the bus or the train with gifts for her. She hadn't met them, she didn't know their names. But they couldn't speak English. They came with these, and they were elderly, too. They came with these gifts to Sarah, and then they cried. And they didn't know Sarah, but they knew, you know, that she was the family. And Sarah was so touched by it. She stood, and she's written out of it in the summer in English. She's taking Swedish this year. For one reason, to communicate with her family there. But these are just random thoughts in my head that I wanted to share.
Well, you were talking about television and how they just don't get the connection on television. So my grandkids, you can see them sitting there watching television. The only time they pay really attention is when the commercial comes on. All of a sudden they're paying attention. But I have 10 grandchildren in the wife. And they when I tell them about the olden days, my first car was a Model Ford, and we had pit toilets. Yeah, exactly. They said their favorite story was about Munts. Now, ever since I can remember, Munts was the name of a cat. Now, every time I had a cat, it must be a Norwegian symbol or something for a cat. Must be. So Nicole would always ask me to tell a story about Munts. So I'll share that little story about Munts. Well, Munts was one of our cats, and it was just a common old animal, but must have had an ancestor that had been an Andorra or something, that had long hair. And so this cat was always, you know,
licking, and he could get this hair down in his stomach, and he'd get hairballs. I don't know if you ever had a cat that got hairballs. So they'd get constipated. So we'd mix some castor oil or something with their food and feed it to them, and usually this would work. But the one time, it didn't work.